Okay, thank you. So I'm going to be talking about models of antibody responses during viral infection, and that's a complete lie. I'm just going to look at it from two points of view, from an HIV viral infection and from a hepatitis B viral infection. So let me give you a little bit of a background. So it's part of the adaptive immune response, and you have these particles produced by the B lymphocytes that go and try to protect the host against the infection. And you have several functions that the antibodies can do. They can neutralize the virus, so they bind to the virus and they prevent entry. But then there's many more functions. You can have complement-mediated lysis of free virus and of antibodies. Then you can have opsonization of virus particles by antibodies, but also you can have the Fc region of the antibodies attracting phagocytes that can either lead to a killing of the infected cell, or you can have antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, which means the same thing, the Fc region of the antibody sends some signaling, the natural killer cells come and kill the infected cell. And here's an example of how that works, and this is in HIV infection. So let's say you have no antibody. You will have the CD4s, the virus will attach to receptor, coreceptor, and it will enter, and they will use this cell as a machinery to produce more viruses. Now, if you have the neutralizing antibodies, then you see these tiny particles that bind to the spikes of the virus, and now there's nothing left that can attach to the receptor on the CD4 T cells, therefore you have protection from infection. And then you have this other function, the effector functions of the antibodies, where you know you attract the phagocytes, they come and kill the infected cell, or you attract the natural killer cells, they come and kill the infected cell. And all of these functions sounds good enough, right? It's some kind of immune protection. Now, in some cases, you don't want this effector function of the antibodies. And the reason for that is, let's think about it from the HIV point of view. You already have a lot of cells dying. You don't want an additional amount of killing due to antibody. You want protection. You don't want killing of CD4 cells. And the other thing that I will be talking about, hepatitis B, you don't want the tissue damage. You don't want portions of your liver being filled up with dead cells. Okay, so mostly everybody that tries to come up with an antibody response tries to come up with a neutralizing antibody response. Okay, so I didn't have this slide before I came to this meeting, but there are several things that you see when people are thinking about antibodies. First of all, you always want to induce antibodies through vaccinations. And there's a lot of examples where that works. And hepatitis B is one of them. Then you have polio and you have measles. And in that case, there's no extra study because you have these antibodies. They work as long as you induce them at regular intervals or for a big enough level. And we're done with that. Or you have the situations, and we heard that yesterday a little bit in influenza, where people are saying, I don't see the antibodies until I'm done with the initial infection. Therefore, I'm not going to use them in my model, or I'm going to think that they are not there. And the reason for that, or my explanation for that, is people tend to only measure for free antibodies. And you see those free antibodies at the moment they are no longer bound to the virus. Right, so you have your initial peak of infection. When that resolutes, your antibodies unbound from that virus, and you start to measure them. But this is an example, and this comes from HIV, and this is Georgia Tamara's group at Duke University. It's part of the CHAVI program of coming up with a vaccine, where they actually measured complex antibodies. And instead of seeing, so if you go into the literature, the majority of the literature, they're going to say you don't see antibodies until very late in the infection. And it turns out she measured plasma donors from all, I think she had B and C clades. And I think if you include C clades, you're safe enough to say you have covered everything, because that's the the most virulent one. And what you see in here is the first line, the one with triangles on it, that is the complex antibodies. And it's complex, I think this is complex IgM and this is complex IgG. And what you see in there, the dotted line, is the free one. Right? So if you're looking for the free antibody, you're going to say, okay, here's my virus. I'm not having any of the antibodies, therefore they are not important. I'm just going to start to worry about them much later. But it turns out the antibodies are there. They are there in, so this for these HIV patients, and I'm showing you six here, but they were 43, I think, in the study. They measured complex virus antibody as early as day 8. Okay, so antibodies do exist. Now, the problem is when you are going into a chronic infection, they don't do much. And it would be interesting to figure out why that doesn't happen. And I'm going to, for the first part of my talk, I will talk about competition between antibodies. So let me tell you a little bit what I mean by that. So antibodies compete with each other for a lot of stimulus. They compete with each other for antigens. They compete with each other for space in the lymph nodes. You can't have B cells proliferating without any control. And also, in order to get an antibody response, you need T cell help. So they compete with each other for T cell conjugates and kinetic prolongation. And I will look at this idea of competition between antibodies. And when I'm talking in this talk about competition between antibodies, I'm actually talking about competition between B cells producing antibodies. So when you hear antibody competitions, it's just B cell competition. And I will look at it from two points of view. I will look at the competition between strain-specific and broadly neutralizing antibodies in HIV, and also in the second part, if I get to it, I will look at competition between antibodies directed to viral particles and antibodies directed to just random surface antigens that are in there in hepatitis B. So let's start with HIV. People have been trying to come up with a vaccine, an antibody-induced vaccine, against HIV since 1980s when we first discovered the virus. And we are progressing in the sense that we are coming up with a lot of antibodies that are broadly neutralizing, yet they are not completely efficient. So initially there were just these four broadly neutralizing antibodies known, and now each year they come up with new broadly neutralizing antibodies. The last three ones that you see in the air were discovered late last year, and they are 78 efficient against all clade types. And this appeared, I think, 9 days ago. It was published in Science, and it's a broadly neutralizing antibody. It's neutralizing 90% of the virus strains. So we have these antibodies, but somehow we don't seem, and that is a good thing. You would think that, you know, if we induce them in vivo, then you would get protection. Now, here are the vaccine trials that emerged since the study of HIV infection. The first one, which was directed at producing neutralizing antibodies, did produce them, but they were highly strain-specific. The virus mutates very fast. As when it drifts apart so that the initial antibodies that you produced don't react anymore, you get an escape. The second one, I'm not going to get into it because it's a T-cell induced vaccine. It's not of an interest for me, but it didn't work. Not only that, it enhanced the HIV infection. And this is the Thailand vaccine that you probably heard in the papers. It was efficient in the sense that it reduced the infectivity rate. It combined the two types of vaccines, so you get boosting through 6 injections that will induce a high CTL immune response, and then you will get a vaccination with the initial vaccine. And it worked. It reduced infectivity by 30%, so it didn't work perfectly. However, a lot of people, Tony Fauci from NIAID, think that it might not be efficient against clade C, and that is the African strain, the big beast. So why can't we come up with this? So I got into this project at the moment when STEP failed, and people were thinking, okay, we're putting too much effort into coming up with this vaccine. Maybe we should go back a little bit and try to understand the basic science behind it. So instead of, you know, coming up with this, let's figure out what goes wrong. So what goes wrong? Well, in terms of virus, we already know that this is an RNA virus. It mutates very fast. It has high diversity in terms of the number of clades, the number of sequences. It also establishes very early in latent population. That is a problem. And then there's this evasion of the humoral and cellular immune system. Now, what am I interested in? Antibodies. All of the studies seem to show that the responses are strain-specific. And somehow, even though we found these monoclonal broadly neutralizing antibodies, we don't seem to induce them in vivo. Why is that? And there are some theories out there. One of them, and this is supported by the Chavi group, the Barr-Haynes group at Duke, is that the B cells that would produce these broadly neutralizing antibodies are actually autoreactive. So you just eliminate them during negative selection. The other one, and a lot of structural biology will tell you this, is the conformation is wrong. So when you're doing mononuclear antibodies, you direct them against one epitope, that's fine, but you have the extra body of the antibody, and you have to fit it in the right place, right? So the whole protein folding gets you in trouble. Then, you know, you have the high rate of mutations. For example, the monoclonal antibody that came up last week in Science comes from, it's mutated 66 times. Usually you will see antibodies that are mutated 10 to 15 times. So getting to that level where it's mutated enough that it's protecting, it's a challenge. And the thing that I will be talking about is the competition. And there's support for that, and I'm not going to get into it. So what do I mean by competition? So we have these strain-specific antibodies. Is it possible that we also have the broadly neutralizing antibodies in the body, but instead of seeing them at levels of detection, they are kept under control by the competition between them and strain-specific antibody? And remember, competition is for antigen. They do get produced by the same stimulus, and then spacing the lymph nodes and the T-cell help. And what we're going to do is we're going to model this competition between these two types of antibodies, and I'm going to give you a mathematical prediction on when things go wrong and what can you do to fix that. And here's how it works. So let's say you have an immunization model. So you get infected with a virus strain. You infect the rhesus macaque with the virus strain, and then several days later you infect it with a different viral strain, so on and so forth. And you would be in the situation where you just produce an antibody that is broadly neutralizing. Maybe it's broadly neutralizing only at the 90% level that we see in VRC01, but still, it's broadly neutralizing. So the model is very simple. I'm just going to think that the virus is produced by a rate by already infected cells, which are proportional with the virus. I'm doing a quasi-study state analysis, and this came from a bigger model where, you know, I'm doing the B-cell differentiation, infection, so on and so forth. And then the antibodies are produced by these viruses that are present, and then they are sustained at a certain level. So this will be homeostasis of B-cell population. And again, if you do a quasi-study state equilibrium, you get a homeostasis of the antibodies. Okay, so if you have that, you have just a broadly neutralizing antibody, then you can come up with a basic reproductive number, which is just the ratio between infectivity, and this is the product between avidity of infection. I'm going to call it avidity, not affinity. So it's a combination of how well you bind and how many spikes you bind, right? And then the lifespan of the antibodies. And if this is less than one, then the viruses will be cleared, and if it's bigger than one, the viruses will persist. Now, if you put in both situations where you have not only the broadly neutralizing antibodies, but you have the strain-specific antibodies competing with each other, the model is exactly the same, except that now you eliminate a virus by both strain-specific and broadly neutralizing antibodies. Here's the other thing, here's the bad part though, now these different types of antibodies compete with each other. Okay, so if you have that, then the basic reproductive number depends on the level of antibodies you produce, the strain-specific and the broadly neutralizing. It also depends on how many times you mutate. Okay, so again, if that's less than one, that the viruses will be cleared. If it's bigger than one, then the viruses will persist. And let's put that together and see what you have. You have this region of parameters. When, if you're in this region, and think about it, you know, you have them at the same time. If you're in this region, if you just produce that broadly neutralizing antibody, even if it's at 90% efficacy, you have the first virus, it gets cleared. When the second comes in, you might have the situation that it doesn't even take off, or it takes off, but it's kept under control. But at the same time, when you have both strain-specific, both broadly neutralizing and strain-specific antibodies, you will get this persistence, because even though the first virus comes in, seems to be cleared, the moment the second virus comes in, the A1 level goes down because A1 competes with A2, right? So the idea is, how am I going to shift this condition to the other side so I get clearance in both cases? Okay, and I did this, so this is just an immunization program. I did this when in natural infection. So the same model, but instead of, you know, just injecting each strain of the virus, you have viruses mutating at certain probability. And the only way this model changes is now you have a mutation matrix. And depending on the type of mutation matrix, you can have, and I'm going to skip all this in the interest of time, you can have the situation where, again, you get viruses being cleared in the presence of just broadly neutralizing antibodies and viruses persisting when antibodies compete with each other. And now the interesting thing about this, I'm just giving you this omega, I'm not telling you what that is, but that's depending on the mutation rate. So based on that, you can figure out, you know, how big of a mutation do you need to have in order to move this thing into the other side. So let me just summarize what I have right now. You have this paradoxical situation where in the presence of just broadly neutralizing antibodies, you get clearance. Yet if you put extra immune response, which should help you, right, you will have the problem of viruses persisting. And think about it from this point of view. In the best case scenario right now, when viruses will neutralize just 90% of the strains out there, you will still have those extra 10% for which you do need these strain-specific antibodies. So figuring out how to, how their competition cannot lead to chronic infection is a very important step. So in our model, and this is very simplistic, and of course you can, if you put these cell differentiations, things change a little bit, you can correct for that by increasing the affinity of the broadly neutralizing antibodies. Then you can have a decrease in the levels, so on and so forth. Okay? And now let's say you answer that problem. Let's say you're creating enough antibodies and they are not competing with each other, they don't cancel each other. What about other questions? How much antibody do you need? We're doing several boosting. For example, for hepatitis B, we're doing 3. Why is that? How much is good enough? And usually the studies are coming from the vitro studies, and at least in HIV, the idea is that you need at least one-fold more than in the vitro studies. Also, how many surface antigens do you need to bind, right? Because you have, and think about it like this. You have surface antigens, right? You attach the antibody to one of them, and let's say you attach another one to another one. Is it enough to have a free one, a free that's not masked by antibody? Is that enough to produce infection? And there are some studies out there in HIV. Initially, it was a one-hit model. If you bind to one surface antigen, you're done with that virus. But now people have started to think that it's enough for you to have one free spike to produce infection. Okay? And not only that, but you have this distribution of the spikes that is non-uniform. So for HIV, there are about 14 viral spikes, and you would get clusters, but also you would have one that's just alone. Now, having clusters is good because it means, you know, the antibody can bind easily. It's also bad because it means it can enter easily. You know, it can find a receptor on the T cells. So these are things that we need to consider. And I'm not going to go, I'm not going to tell you we're doing that. We're considering, you know, is it important to bind one, two, so on and so forth? What's the average level that you see, where you see the binding? Instead, I'm going to tell you a little bit a simpler problem than that, and it comes from hepatitis B, where I'm going to show you that just having a certain level of antibody might not be protective enough. And that might happen because the virus has a way of escaping. And here's an example. Hepatitis B, why am I doing this? It's much simpler. You don't have, it's an DNA virus. It doesn't mutate so much. So I don't have that whole idea of, you know, after 2 weeks, it's a different virus because it mutated. So it's a little bit easier to talk about antibodies. And however, if you have, and we have a very good vaccine. Now, if you're not vaccinated, some of the people, 10%, 5%, 10%, are getting chronic infections. Why does that happen? Why isn't the antibody efficient for that? And in our previous studies, we looked at CTL immune responses. We looked at the possibility of cells that are cured, and you can cure the virus without killing the cell, becoming refractory to infections. But what about antibodies? So here's some things that you should consider. So the antibody, the vaccine against hepatitis B, that is very efficient, has induces anti-surface antigen antibodies. So people also, in natural infection, people seem to produce these antibodies, and they seem to help with resolution of the infection. However, you get those few cases where you have chronicity. What can happen there? And this is one thing that we were looking at, and this is where I'm going to tell you that levels of antibodies are important. So instead of just producing these virons, the hepatitis B produces antiparticles, and they can be spheres and they can be filaments. Anyways, they don't have the DNA inside of it, but they have the surface antigen. So now you have the problem of you producing enough antibodies, but maybe they are not neutralizing the right things. They are neutralizing the particles that don't even have DNA inside, so the particles that are not going to harm you. And these particles are produced at a higher rate. It's 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000. So what we did is, okay, let's put that in a model. Let's see if we can actually see that the fact that you have antibodies triggering these things instead of the virus, can that move you from natural clearance to chronicity? And the virus, the model is very simple. You've seen it a few times yesterday. So you have uninfected cell, infected cells, but now you have production of viruses, and I'm going to call these particles. And for simplicity, I'm going to consider that it's just a fraction theta that's 10,000 more than producing virus particles. And then you have the production of antibodies. Now, the problem is that only this complex antibody will that be beneficial for you. This complex of antibodies with viral particles are not going to help out. And I'm going to skip that, and I'm just going to show you a result. So if you consider that simple model, and you consider that parameter theta, the number of subviral particles in there, can you predict clearance versus chronicity? And this looks like a fit. It's not. We have patients, and we're doing the fit right now. I just want to show you that theta is indeed a bifurcation parameter, and you can go from clearance to actual chronicity. So you'd think that if you are in an infection long enough and you're producing these subviral particles, then the antibody response has to be very high because most of it will be soaked into binding to subviral particles. And I'm just going to conclude. So competition between antibody-producing B cells can explain inefficacy of antibodies in the terms in the study with HIV, I showed you that the most fit antibody wins, and then also you have the issue of how much antibody you need to produce in order to get protection. And of course, this study will then, what we want is to see how we translate this information into vaccine trials. So for example, in hepatitis B, the reason you're producing these subviral particles is there a little bit of imbalance between surface antigens, there's S, M, L. And, you know, if you can suppress some of them or induce some of them, maybe the antibody will trigger the right region. And I'm going to end here. I want to acknowledge some people. I've been starting the HIV study while I was a postdoc at Duke with Tom Kepler. Patrick Dunley here is a mathematician at the University of Florida. He helps with analysis of the models. And I'm doing hepatitis B for many, many years, and this study also with Alan Perlson and Rui Ribeiro from Los Alamos. Thank you.